Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
More jitters in crypto as lender Genesis appeals for cash.
The crypto world is vastly intertwined, and we're still in the process of understanding the knock-on effects of the bankruptcy of FTX.
Plus, the OECD calls on the European Central Bank to hike rates faster and higher, and why projections of a $1 trillion year for stock buybacks hasn't come to pass. It's Tuesday, November 22nd. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal, and here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. Cryptocurrency lender Genesis Global Capital has asked crypto exchange Binance for an investment and private equity giant Apollo Global Management for capital assistance, according to people familiar with the matter. Binance decided not to invest, fearful that some of Genesis's business could create a conflict of interest down the line, according to one of the people familiar with the matter. A Genesis spokesman said the company has, quote, no plans to file bankruptcy imminently, adding that it continues to have constructive conversations with creditors. Genesis has faced a rush of withdrawals from its lending arm following the collapse of crypto exchange FTX, and Journal Markets reporter Caitlin McCabe has more.
When you see something as big as FTX collapse, we know that Genesis was more directly intertwined with the crypto empire of Sam Bankman-Fried, in the sense that Genesis had loans outstanding to Alameda Research, which was the sister trading firm of FTX. And so it's hard to know at this point exactly what might happen if Genesis doesn't get this cash infusion, but we know it wouldn't be good for its customers, and we also know that it had $2.8 billion in active loans at the end of the third quarter. So it's definitely intertwined with a lot of other companies and crypto companies out there.
The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD, warned today that the European Central Bank must raise its key interest rate much higher in order to bring down inflation that is set to be persistently higher. In its latest economic forecast, the OECD said it expects inflation to remain especially stubborn in Europe through next year, averaging nearly twice as high as the U.S., following Moscow's decision to throttle natural gas supplies to undermine Western support for Kyiv. The OECD recommend that the ECB raise rates from 1.5% now to between 4 and 4.25% by the middle of next year, a much higher peak than that anticipated by investors. Turning to the U.S. now, investor home purchases tumbled by 30% in the third quarter, according to real estate brokerage Redfin, the steepest percentage decline since the second quarter of 2020 and the subprime crisis before that. The pullback signals that rising borrowing rates and high home prices that have pushed traditional buyers to the sidelines are also causing investing firms to do the same. Heads up, Thanksgiving travelers, holiday air travel this week is slated to approach pre-pandemic levels. That is according to the U.S. Transportation Security Administration, which is projecting 2.5 million passengers or more to pass through U.S. airports on the busiest travel days, nearing the 2.9 million passengers seen around Thanksgiving 2019. And in other market news today, computer maker HP, retailers Best Buy and Dollar Tree, software maker VMware, and medical device company Medtronic are set to headline another day of quarterly earnings. The world's biggest pizza chain is going electric. with some of its delivery vehicles, that is. We are reporting this week that Domino's Pizza plans to procure 800 Domino's-branded Chevrolet Bolts for select franchisees around the country. And Wall Street Journal restaurants reporter Heather Haddon joins us now with a look at the significance of this planned electric vehicle purchase. Hi, Heather. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much.
So what is the rationale for Domino's doing this exactly?
So Domino's has two rationales. One is they do have these green commitments that a lot of companies have made to try to reduce their carbon footprint. But more immediately, Domino's and really the whole pizza industry this year has really been struggling with a driver shortage. And so Domino's did a whole review this year of its operations to try to figure out what might help. And one thing that pizza location operators were mentioning is that if they had cars on site, that might be something they could use to attract drivers. So drivers typically use their own personal vehicles to deliver pizza, and that can be expensive. So Domino's is hoping that having these new cool-looking branded electric vehicles at some of its shops will be a way that their operators can say, hey, you want to drive for us? We've got a car here that you can use.
Is it likely we'll see Domino's competitors and other companies maybe outside of the pizza space following suit with a strategy like this? It's not cheap, I imagine, to acquire these vehicles and the charging stations and all the rest.
Yeah, there's definitely an investment that Domino's and its operators are making to do this. What sort of stands out about Domino's is they do not use any of the apps, the DoorDashes of the world, to deliver their pizza. So they have had this stance that is becoming increasingly unusual amongst pizza and even restaurants in general, that they want their pizza to be delivered by their own drivers. They say it's more profitable. They say the service is better. But they're an outlier here. Certainly other kinds of companies are getting deep into EVs. Often those are delivery-oriented companies such as Amazon, FedEx, Uber. But, you know, it's pretty unusual for a food delivery company and particularly a pizza company to go into these EVs. So I don't think we're going to see a lot of followers yet, but let's see how this Domino's experiment goes.
That was Wall Street Journal reporter Heather Haddon, who covers the restaurant industry for us. Heather, thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, a looming U.S. tax on share repurchases was supposed to inspire a buyback bonanza this year, but it hasn't. Wall Street Journal Heard on the Street editor Spencer Jacob will join us after the break with a look at why.
Join the Wall Street Journal at the Future of Everything Festival on May 21st to 23rd in New York City, where diverse global newsmakers share unique perspectives on navigating a changing world. Immerse yourself in live performances, explore pioneering technologies, and indulge in the city's inventive culinary scene. As a podcast listener, enjoy 20% off current ticket rates with code PODCAST. Visit wsj.com/FOEF podcast to secure your spot.
2022 was supposed to be a banner year for stock buybacks. Goldman Sachs and others had predicted that buybacks for companies in the S&P 500 would cross the $1 trillion threshold. But instead, after a raucous first quarter of buybacks, that momentum has fizzled, and now that $1 trillion threshold no longer looks likely to be crossed. So what happened? Wall Street Journal Heard on the Street editor Spencer Jacob is joining us now to explain. Spencer, thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So remind us first why companies seem to love buybacks in the first place.
So there are a few things that a company can do when it generates cash. It can pay down debt. It can pile up cash on its balance sheet. It can invest in something, you know, buy a machine or invest in software. But there are limits to its ability to do that. And it shouldn't just do that, because the reason that we all own a company is that it eventually returns cash as a dividend or as a buyback. And buybacks are very misunderstood. They're really financially very close to being a dividend and superior in some ways, because if you're a long-term shareholder of a company, you're not forced to take cash and pay tax on it. So it's painted in a very negative light. And the reason it's painted in a negative light is because management seems to prefer buybacks. They've vastly overtaken dividends in the last couple of decades. because they own a lot of options in the company, and so it disproportionately enriches them.
So despite that logic, why didn't we see these big buyback predictions not really come to fruition this year?
Well, buybacks were pretty high, and they started out the year with the record. And the expectation, because there was the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, passed this summer, contained a tax that's set to take effect next year on stock buybacks, not on dividends, just on buybacks. And, you know, whenever you have a new tax passed or a rule like this passed, what you tend to have is a surge in the activity that the tax is intended to discourage. And so the expectation was that you'd have a bunch of companies basically trying to get in under the wire, get all their buybacks done, or get more of them done than they were planning to next year so that they wouldn't have to pay the tax. And that did not happen. You've actually had two straight quarters of pretty big declines year over year in buybacks. And the reason for that is kind of counterintuitive, because when stock prices go down, then buybacks have more bang for the buck. Stock prices did go down. We went into a bear market. And so those buybacks repurchase more shares. They're reducing the share count more than they would have when stocks were at a record high at the beginning of the year, and buybacks were also at a record high. But companies don't act that way. They zig when they should zag in terms of doing buybacks, kind of like individual investors. We sell when we should buy and buy when we should sell.
Does that trend then mean that this 1% tax on net buybacks set to take effect in January didn't achieve the aim it set out to achieve?
Well, ironically, it's going to achieve the opposite aim, because the tax is on net buybacks. And so lots of companies, particularly tech companies, give options to their executives. That's a big way of rewarding them. And then they sterilize those options. So basically, manager, you know, pays $4 for a share of stock that's really trading at $15 or something like that. That's a way of paying them indirectly, share-based compensation. But more shares have been created through these options being exercised. And some companies spend a lot of money basically indirectly paying their managers by soaking up those additionally created shares. So they haven't actually reduced the number of shares that you, a shareholder, own. They just issued some and soaked them up. And those companies are not going to wind up paying the tax. If all they do is soak up the shares and indirectly enrich their managers, which is kind of the corporate greed that you would think that Congress was upset about, that's fine. That's not taxed. It's the companies that just buy back shares and don't issue many, or in some cases any, options. Like Berkshire Hathaway is one that buys back a lot of its own stock, but it doesn't enrich Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger and other people with options as like an indirect way of paying them. So you're kind of punishing those companies that are kind of doing the right thing for their shareholders and not punishing those that are really enriching corporate fat cats.
Okay. And so, Spencer, as you laid out there, it seems like this tax is not going to have its fully intended effect, but it will clearly have an effect starting January 1st onwards for investors and for these companies, no?
Yes, it is a tax. It's a tax on companies. And most companies, when they buy back shares, they buy back more shares than they grant to management. But if you want to look at it from the point of view of most people don't own just one or two stocks or single stock. They own a bunch of stocks through some mutual fund, maybe an index fund or something like that. And so how much of a drag will it be for you as a long-term shareholder investing for your retirement or whatever? And Howard Silverblatt of S&P Dow Jones Indices went back and did a calculation that had the tax been in effect in 2021, it would have reduced the profits of S&P 500 companies by about 0.5%. And that's not nothing either. It's a kind of a permanent hit to corporate profits. And so it's a tax. Of course, it would be much more efficient just to say, let's just raise corporate taxes across the board on everyone, because this rule is really only punishing those companies that are doing a pretty good job at returning their profits to you.
That was Wall Street Journal Heard on the Street editor Spencer Jacob. Spencer, thanks so much for breaking this down for us.
Sure, thanks.
And finally, if you've been seeing an increasing number of carefully composed LinkedIn posts by chief marketing officers or CMOs lately, there may be a reason for it. According to a survey by the CMO Council, 80% of marketing execs now say they're actively developing their own brands, with goals ranging from simple self-promotion to marketing their employers in a different way. Reputation management companies are also reporting a surge in new CMO clients. And Wall Street Journal reporter Patrick Coffey says that while marketers have been known to promote themselves in the past, there's a reason the trend is intensifying.
Primarily, the increasing usage of social media and the need then that marketers feel to speak out on topics both within and beyond the industry. There's a perception that if a CMO says nothing about an issue like, say, Black Lives Matter, then consumers will read that as their employer's implicit endorsement of the status quo on that issue. So that's the reason that CMOs feel the need to sometimes bring in some outside help to help them determine what they say in public so that they can be on LinkedIn and on Twitter and on TikTok and simultaneously doing their day jobs.
And that's What's News for Tuesday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show after I promote this podcast on LinkedIn, of course. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.